music lovers. Welcome to Wax Chatty with D. Muck and Taddy, where three pals listen to an album, then come together and discuss the dang thing.
What the heck is an album?
An album is a collection of audio recordings issued on compact disc, vinyl, audio tape, or another medium such as digital distribution.
Nice! All of our selections can be found on Apple Music, Spotify, Discogs, even in your local record store if you fancy doing some crate digging.
In the beginning of 2021, the Muck and Taddy duo started this exploration. And after we had nearly 50 albums under our belts, we brought in Deanna, and it morphed into a podcast for you so that we could share our blinding brilliance.
Come and get on the bus with us while we wax lyrical about wax.
So let's grip it and rip it, people.
Hello, hello, hello. Thanks for joining us for episode 8 of Wax Chatty with D, Muck, and Taddy. All right, Deanna, what was your album choice that we will be discussing today?
My album choice was Superfly, which is the third studio album by Curtis Mayfield. And it was released in July of 1972 on Curtum Records. It was the soundtrack for the blaxploitation film, Superfly. And it's considered a classic. And it's got some wonderful singles like Freddy's Dead, which was number 2 on the R&B charts.
Your Pusher Man.
And Pusher Man's my favorite song, personally. But and then Superfly was one of the few soundtracks to outgross the film itself. And also the title track, Superfly, was number 5 on the R&B charts and number 8 on the pop. Curtis Mayfield is just an incredible musician. This album I love, there's an album that he did in 71 called Curtis Live. A lot of the songs from that he did from his album Curtis in 1970 were just the live version. I mean, live albums oftentimes can be so much better than just the studio versions, in my opinion. He was getting very socially aware at the time. And this is after he left the Impressions, because originally he was with the Impressions, then basically with the Civil Rights Movement. And after the Civil Rights Act of 64, once the Impressions started producing music more along that same vein, he ended up doing songs like People Get Ready, which was a huge hit. And in 70, he left the Impressions and started a solo career. This is really interesting in terms of the blaxploitation, because a lot of folks were kind of like, well, the film itself seems to almost put Pusher Man in the whole machismo of everything, of dealers and pimps and all of that, in a good light. But actually, and the tendency of these blaxploitation films to kind of glorify that thing, it was originally targeted to mostly Black lower class audiences. But his album was something totally different, as I know you guys can see, because with a lot of the songs, it talks about how the ghetto victims are actually falling into this never-ending cycle, and they're
Phil and I didn't even listen to this album this week, Deanna. You were on your own. I don't know.
Wow. Yeah, I know. No one has any clue. I'm in some kind of
other dimension. Being junkies the entire week.
I was too, actually. And he was like, well, I don't see why people are complaining about the subject of these films. The way you clean up the films is by cleaning up the streets, which I thought was really brilliant. He started out his career in a gospel choir. He received his first guitar when he was 10. And in an interview later, he recalled that he loved his guitar so much he used to sleep with it, which reminds me of Jimi Hendrix. I just thought that was really beautiful. And then I failed to mention this, but he was born in Chicago. And later on, back, I think it was in 1990 in Flatbush, Brooklyn, he was doing a live performance at Wingate Field, and lighting equipment fell on top of him and paralyzed him from the neck down. And that was, you know, he was like that until the end of his days, but he continued recording. He couldn't play guitar anymore. But
Luther Vandross in that car wreck. Oof.
Oh, God. Yeah. He was able to still record, but he couldn't play anymore. But he composed and sang. And apparently he found he could do by lying down and letting gravity pull down on his chest and lungs. He won a Grammy Legend Award in 94 and a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award in 95. Is a double inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, first as a member of the Impressions and again as a solo artist. And then
don't get me started on that Rock and Roll Hall of Fame bullshit.
Yeah. Oh God. Joke. All those things. Yeah, I mean, I add things. Them. I add them in as.
No, but the
as
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is like number one. It's the dumbest thing in the world. It really is so stupid.
Yeah, it really is. But you know, I throw it in there as icing on the cake. You know, but then he died of complications from diabetes in 99, in December of 90. He died on the same day as my father. But yes, December 26, 1999. So that's what I've got. Tell me your thoughts.
I loved it. You grow up on the radio hearing some of these songs and you think you know them, but then really listening to them.
It's pronounced radio, okay? Radio. Correct pronunciation is I'm the voice. I'm the voice of the machine, the radio. Okay, proceed.
On the FM radio. I think I was listening to FM at the time. But, you know, and then listening to it now, and, you know, hearing so much more, and especially the lyrics. I mean, come on. These lyrics are amazing. I actually, after listening to the first song, Ghetto Child Running Wild, I was like, I got to know more about this because it sounds so autobiographical. And it is. It is autobiographical. I mean, the lyrics make it sound like he knows what he's talking about, which he does. And also, like, just his delivery, it seems so personal to me, even though the song is, you know, funky and, you know, got a good beat, you could dance to it. But yeah, he did grow up in poverty in Chicago.
You know, the Pusherman song and Superfly, which I love that they put the Superfly at the end of,
yeah,
of the 9-track album, is very interesting. He's just describing these guys. And yeah, then for Nothing on Me, the cocaine song, he's saying, nope, don't do this.
Yeah.
Don't get involved with this. It's bad. Yeah. And then it's like the one song that it's really like, I'm good. I don't need it. And where he describes all the other, you know, pimps and, you know, pushers that are doing it. And then I think it's him saying no, which.
Yeah. I mean, he did talk about that. Yeah. He did say that he was, once he started seeing the rushes, he's quoted as saying, this seems like a cocaine infomercial.
What are you talking about? The album or the film?
When he was watching rushes while he was developing songs.
Right.
He said, oh, I didn't get this from the script. I didn't get that it was an infomercial for cocaine from the script. And he felt like he had to start to. And I was like, wait a minute. Is that really a quote? Maybe that was a quote later. Because I was like, wait, the word infomercial, is that from the 70s? Maybe it was. He did feel like he wanted to make sort of the conscious of the movie, and I think he's pretty successful at that. Talk about, like you said, these are about characters. I mean, they're pretty great little character studies. They're almost like, I don't know, they're almost like a little movie on their own, you know.
Yes.
Like you,
yes,
really get the feel for Freddie and Eddie and Superfly, the Pusherman.
What's crazy is Freddie. So we know what happened to, sorry, I watched the movie because I had never seen it. I can't believe that. And I was talking to Bill the other day, and we're like, well, we're not going to talk about the movie. We have to talk about the album. And I'm like, well, you know, he kind of wrote the thing for the movie. And like, you know, Freddie dies. Freddie gets pushed in front of a car, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, I was expecting like some crazy gun fight, you know, but no, he gets pushed in front of a car. And what's so cool about this and fantastic about this album is, Fishbone pulled Freddy's Dead, and the opening for Superfly is the opening for Eggman on Paul's Boutique by the Beastie Boys.
Yes.
And I was like, damn, what is that? I know exactly what it is. And I was listening to it today and I was like, oh, so great sampling. But you know, Curtis, it's even sounds like, you know, like Little Child Running Man is, he's got an orchestra under that with the violin.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know how many people they had in the studio, but it was just, it sounds fantastic. And you're like, I kind of want to, you know how they would do, there's this new movie Tar with Cate Blanchett, and she's a composer. And so the whole movie goes, and she ends up going through a bunch of lifestyle things, and she ends up composing soundtracks to movies. And so I kind of want to go see this, the movie with a live orchestra playing this. I think that would be fantastic. Like Star Wars kind of.
Right.
But that would be great to go see this.
It's funny that you say that about the instruments and musicians, because I got so curious that I ended up picking up the biography that's written about Curtis Mayfield, that's written by his son. But anyway, they did record all this live, or most of it live. And at one point they said they had so many people that the backup singers had to be in the control room because there wasn't room. Like, it was so packed because they wanted to record it live with harps and, you know, strings and everything.
Well, totally worth it. It sounds great.
Yeah, the arrangements are pretty freaking cool, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Man.
I was walking across the street listening to the album when Deanna first did it. And, you know, I'm in it and I know the album. And then we get to the Junkie Chase, the instrumental, which is fantastic. You know, and I'm like, you're in the middle of New York. You're walking across the street.
Yes.
I almost got hit by four cars, a bicycle, a tram, whatever. I mean, I was like, I have to cut this off. Because it was more cacophonous than the city itself. I was waiting for the, you know, Roosevelt Ferry to drop on me kind of thing. It was just like so much was going on.
Yeah, it reminded me so much of New York City, even just sitting in my living room listening to it. I can't imagine walking the streets of New York City trying to listen to this.
I wasn't in Harlem, but, you know, I was down in Midtown, and that's, you know, crazy.
Even though the script was written and he immediately got inspiration to write these songs, you can almost imagine that the movie came from the album, you know? These things are so specific and so narrative and so cinematic in their own way that it's like somebody listened to it and made up a movie, although that's not what happened. But I think
it's like the montages, you know? It's like, no, yeah. Here's the song, here, now go
yeah.
do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Go
yeah,
do
yeah.
what the song says. Oh, the actor's like, oh, I didn't realize this about the character.
I'm sure the film would have been much better had they done it that way around.
Yeah. Woo-hoo, boy. Wow. I did also, I have not finished the movie, but I also got curious and watched about a third of it. The acting is very earnest. Very, very earnest.
It's very PC, don't you think? It runs the gamut.
Yeah, I do hear things. I mean, I have been listening to it quite a bit. In fact, I listened to it this morning again, and you do hear things that at repeated listening, just because the music is so textured and interesting, and it's just so great.
I mean, it's fantastic.
And it's so danceable, but you don't feel like you want to be smiling while you're dancing. You know what I mean? Because... Yeah. Of the themes.
So like I said, the Beastie Boys sampled Superfly for Eggman, and they actually mention Dolomite, that other blaxploitation film that Eddie Murphy did a remake of, and they mention it in the Eggman, and I'd never heard that before. I love Paul's Boutique, that album.
Yeah, it's a wonderful album.
So they were blowing homage smoke in that song. No, but great pick, Deanna. To watch the movie.
I remember, like, I mean, again, like, I always go back to my college years, because that's when I started meeting different folks who just were very radically different than the kids I went to school with in private school in New York City, and really opened me up to seeing all kinds of stuff, like you do when you go away to college, or if you don't go to college, you have some kind of experience that takes you outside of your regular norm. And when I saw this film, I was really blown away, but then the soundtrack, and actually getting to see Curtis play
in the movie,
I was so like, cool. Oh yeah, it was wonderful. And that's what kind of got me really into him. And so I was trying to, okay, I want to get to that. And then the Curtis live, because since I saw him live, I was like, oh, they're going to have, you know, and listen to this. Oh, they're going to have like congos and all kinds of shit going on. I want, you know, so I definitely recommend that album. I know we're just talking about this one, but we've, you know, he influenced so much. And I'm really glad you brought up Fishbone, because that was something I was going to mention as well. Fishbone became one of my go-to favorite albums when I was in high school with my little cassette player.
Which album?
Walkman, Truth and Soul.
Yeah.
And so when that came out, that just, I listened to it every day. It was just Freddy's Dead, I loved. And it wasn't until years later that I was like, oh my God, holy shit. That's where this song comes from, you know, because at the time I didn't look up where things came from. Now, what I found interesting, and I, what I told you guys when I picked this, was that there are so many different versions. Like even on Spotify, I found so many, and I don't know how Spotify does this, if it's just random people can upload stuff and then not check with one another, because of course you have your 25th, 35th anniversary versions that also included two other tracks, one of which was the Superfly theme song or whatever. But I was reading that basically Freddy's Dead was so popular that, and they saw how popular it was, that they kind of made that into its own instrumental that you hear throughout the film. And then that's put on one of the other versions, you know. But I was surprised to see so many different versions of this. But that other one, it reminded me a little bit more of the Fishbone with the heavy bass, the much heavier bass. So to be in full disclosure, I love Curtis Mayfield, obviously, and I love, but I actually like Fishbone's version of Freddy's Dead a little more. But I guess it kind of depends on what mood I'm in, but I do kind of dig theirs more because there's something harder about it. But that's because I was originally a Fishbone junkie. See what I just did there? Before.
Well, it's kind of 70s versus 90s, truthfully.
Yeah.
Yes. So it is a thing of when you grow up, but.
What was impressionable then? 70s, correct. Very chill and very groovy. And then Fishbone is very hard, you know,
yeah.
20 years later, you know, it's a completely different style.
Quick trivia about the version of Pusher Man. The album wasn't cut yet. They knew the songs, but the album wasn't cut yet. They wanted to shoot that scene. And the director, you know, Gordon Parks Jr. needed the song to film the scene, excuse me. So Curtis Mayfield was like, okay, guys, we got to go to New York and we're going to be in this movie and we're going to go in the studio. And they were like, huh? And they went and they, on the night before of shooting, of the shoot,
they called Steppenwolf and asked what the Pusher Man song would be. Sorry.
Yeah. But they cut it that night and then sang it. Well, didn't sing it, but lip synced to it the next day, and none of the band had heard it before, and there hadn't been an arrangement made of it. They made it up. They made up that recorded version of Pusher Man on the spot
that
night before they shot the scene.
Wow,
that's fantastic. Where'd you read that?
In the biography.
Oh, in the bio. Cool.
Yeah.
It's called Traveling Soul: The Life of Curtis Mayfield, and it's written by his son Todd Mayfield. It's really quite good. It's well written, and it moves quickly, and yeah, it's really great. Man, it's just like the way he phrases, I don't know what word to use, the way he says the word Pusher Man in the song, it's so evocative, but it seems to be almost like two things. It almost means like, it sounds to me like he's kind of being cool, like the Pusher Man is so cool, but he's also like saying the Pusher Man's kind of evil, you got to watch out for him. Do you know what I mean? Just the what's in his voice, the way he says the word, it's so expressive.
Not
well, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's the thing. Yeah. It's like dead on for, you know, what he's thinking about. I really do like, I don't know why I feel guilty about saying this, silly, but that song that you mentioned that's kind of an anti-drug song, I can't remember the title of it right now.
No,
I really
thing
like
on
that
me.
Song. No, yeah, thing I really grown to like that song.
Oh,
a lot.
It's fantastic.
It's kind of, you know, that the piano flourish at the beginning is a little like, I like it, it fits, but it's a little like hokey, or I don't know, but I can't think. But
well, come on, the hokiest one on there is probably Give Me Your Love, which is the bathtub sex scene.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great. It's great. But, you know, and then I was, after watching the movie, I went back and listened to the album and I was like, oh, that's the suds and titties shot. You know?
Yes. It is.
All right. Okay. One more. I'm sorry. I swear to God, I won't quote it again. Really quick. The author of the book, his son, said that they actually gave him something that was like a before videotape rushes at his home so he could make the stuff. And they would sneak in and while he was asleep, watch that scene. They were like 6 and 7, but they would watch. They knew because they were watching him work, and then they saw the scene, and then they'd sneak in when I was sleeping and watch it again.
Oh, that's great.
We saw some titties. Yeah.
Yeah, just one thing to go back to the Pusher Man. That was always, I mean, I loved the whole album, but that was actually in and of itself my favorite song on the album that got me so hooked on it, because some of those lyrics were, yeah, like you said, Bill, it's like, you know, I'm the pusher, I'm the, you know, yeah, you know, you could see him like almost walking down the street and like tossing Coke bags and whatever at people, kind of reminded me of the film American Pop by Ralph Bakshi, but that's a whole other thing. And then he's got lines where, you know, I've got a woman, you know, I love, and I gotta try to get out of this, but I don't know how, and this is the only way. So it goes that thing back and forth where, yeah, you're like, ah, you're a pusher man, you're that douchebag. But then it's like, you know, it's a vicious cycle that he's stuck in and wanting to get out. And
It's great. Two bags, please, for a generous fee. Make your world what you want it to be. Got a woman I love desperately. Want to give her something better than me. So I'm just going to give her a big bag of cocaine.
It just drips with ambivalence. And also in Ghetto Child Running Wild, I mean, that's just a brilliant song in terms of being able to, you know, summarize the issue.
Little Child Running
Wild. Sorry. Like that one line, which is about, I didn't ask to be here, or I didn't need to be here, something like that. It made me so much think of my childhood, in that I was even as a kid aware of, okay, I'm grown, I'm living in this suburb, and then like 25 minutes away from where I am, there's kids that do not have 1/10 of the advantage I have, and it's just luck. You know what I mean? Like, And he seems to say that in that song. And then ironically, he would have been down there, but I wouldn't have been alive then. He was older than me.
His last album that he recorded after he'd had his accident was also really good. And it's like the cover of it, he just looks, it's very serious. It's almost heartbreaking because I knew that something had happened, but at the time, you know, I was just, I don't know, I didn't dig deep into these things. I was just like, oh, I know he's not well, whatever, but I didn't realize what had actually happened.
Oh, crazy.
For Christ's sake, you know, you're doing your gig, you're having a great time, and a freaking lighting thing falls on you. Like, what? The fact that he was still able to record afterwards and had the will to do so is...
Well, I will give this two big toes up and two big thumbs up.
Yeah, right on.
Yeah.
Right on,
it's, man.
It's really something. It's
Can
really
you
something.
Dig it? Can you dig it? Yes, it's absolutely. Great.
So I'm going to throw out for next week, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Bibbidi bop and bibbidi boop 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 and shnip a bop doop. From
1965.
Get ready. We're going back. We're going to do an album called Pastel Blues by Nina Simone.
Oh, brilliant.
Now we're, yeah.
All right, here we go. 5, 4, 3, 2, kick. Okay, people, that's a wrap.
Thank you for listening to the Wax Chatty Podcast. If you enjoyed what was in your ears, please rate us and leave us a comment on Spotify or Apple and share this dude with your homies.
We'd love to hear your thoughts. Be nice now. And look forward to rapping about our next selection.
Stay tuned.
Good night, John Boy.
Good night, John Boy.